Hello, and welcome to the AAMFT podcast, your all-access pass to the latest news, developments, and thought leaders in the world of systemic therapy. We strive to relate, educate, and innovate one episode at a time. I'm your host, Dr. Eli Karam, and we're brought to you by the American Association for Marriage and Family Therapy. Our podcast explores topics that relationship-based therapists care about. In addition to featuring unique conversations and interviews with established experts, our show provides information and education on direct practice and emerging trends in the MFT profession. For more information, please visit us at aamft.org. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show. In the ever-evolving world of technology, the role that artificial intelligence, AI, plays in various aspects of our lives is becoming increasingly more significant. Although there is growing evidence that supports the integration of embodied AI into mental health services, in order to successfully and responsibly implement AI services into our systemic therapy settings, the ethical and social implications of AI use must first be considered. Current developments in AI for mental health have raised important debates around its uses in psychotherapy, including how and under what circumstances AI may be valuable to improve and expand access to psychotherapy. I am pleased to be joined by friend of the show and systemic therapy technology expert, Dr. Kat Hartline, as we discuss the use of AI technology as supplements to our practice of systemic therapy. We're going to talk about the benefits that AI offers, things like note-taking, reviewing and summarizing client notes, creating tailored exercises, treatment plans, billing, even arranging and scheduling client sessions. But we also have to balance that with the constraints, including understanding the limitations of what AI will never be able to offer, the risk involved with AI, the fact that AI should never be used for a crisis response, or necessarily relying on AI for mental health diagnosis alone, and many data and privacy and security issues that you have to worry about if you use AI-based tools. Dr. Catherine Hartline is a professor and the new Associate Dean of Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Bunshaft School of Medicine at Wright State University. She received her master's degree in MFT from Purdue University Calumet, now known as Purdue Northwest, and her doctorate in human development with a specialization in MFT from Virginia Tech, under the tutelage of the legendary, also former guest and friend of the show, Dr. Fred Piercy. Across her academic career, Kat has published over 100 articles, book chapters, and 12 standalone books. She's won numerous awards for her research, teaching, and mentorship. In 2018-19, she was awarded a prestigious Fulbright Core Scholar Award. And during that time, she served as a guest lecturer and guest researcher at the University of Salzburg. That's in Austria. She's been the editor-in-chief of the Journal of Couple and Relationship Therapy, and her work has been featured in various media outlets, including Men's Health, The Atlantic, Huffington Post. She regularly lectures nationally and internationally on technology, couples, and intimacy. And when she's not working and being productive, Kat, true to her Chicago roots, enjoys deep dish pizza, painting, and watching old Cary Grant movies. This is a very important dialogue, and I learned a ton. Hopefully you will too. We will be back after our interview. Narrative Practices and Emotions by Marie Nathaniel Boydoin and Gerald Monk provides a fresh perspective for new and experienced professionals alike on how to combine classic narrative therapy with the latest scholarship on the mind-body connection. Praised by narrative therapy co-originator David Epstein, this book includes clinical questions, embodied exercises, conversation maps, and case studies that will help clients re-engage with their well-being. AMFT podcast listeners will receive 20% discount and free shipping when using code NPE, that's code NPE, at www.norton.com/NPE, www.norton.com/NPE. This offer is valid through December 1st for U.S.-based customers. Eli back on the AAMFT podcast with friend of the show. In fact, we talked to her in the first season, and now we are nearing the end of 2024 of our sixth season. And this is a person you go to in all things systemic therapy and MFT around technology. She's really established her career that way for the last two decades. I'm talking about Kat Hartline. Welcome to the show. Our topic today, AI, probably this year by far the most requested. So I thought for sure I would reach out to you. So as we have this dialogue today, it's about not just AI therapy, but AI supplements as it relates to psychotherapy, specifically the practice of couple and family therapy. So first question, my friend, why is there so much excitement about using AI in mental health?
Hi, Eli. It's great to be back here. So thank you so much for inviting me. I think there's a lot of excitement because AI has the potential to do so many things. When we think about the mental health crisis and the shortage of practitioners that we have, it is one of the most important challenges that we are facing as a community and as a society. So we as practitioners have been looking for ways, really since before COVID, to develop large-scale, very high-quality mental health services to be able to provide to people who might not normally have the access. And AI provides such a great opportunity to be able to do that.
And for those listeners that are not familiar, when we say AI therapy or kind of the related supplements, what exactly are we talking about?
It's a great question. So with telebehavioral health, as specifically as it pertains to psychotherapy, we have to first think about what is psychotherapy generally. So generally, you think about, all right, psychotherapy is some communication between a client and a therapist. And the whole goal of that is to get some relief from a problem they're having, to maybe feel less anxiety or less depression or less fear, to find a way to deal with some of the things that life hands us in terms of the grief and the disappointment. And maybe at least for systemic therapists, to help people to better enjoy their relationships. When you put on an AI lens, we also have to talk about telebehavioral health. In my view, AI is one piece and is within telebehavioral health. Telebehavioral health is any of the technology that helps us to get information about clients, to communicate with clients, or to deliver some sort of service remotely. And that could be done in a way that reduces stigma. Often telebehavioral health, whether it's on video calls or phone or whatever it might be, would reduce travel to the appointments during around the time when you might have illnesses running around. It reduces the transmission of illness. It tends to be pretty cost effective. And telebehavioral health generally has been shown to be really effective for things like anxiety and eating disorders and OCD and PTSD and substance abuse, depression, lots of different things. So when we think about kind of general telebehavioral health, we're talking about video calls, telephone, text messaging, emails, anything that touches the client in a way that isn't that direct face-to-face experience. Now, the AI piece of it is any sort of software or hardware that is designed by people that tries to perceive the environment and act in a way that's going to best achieve the goals, okay? So we're basically enabling machines and systems to look around in the environment, gather information and say, how do I need to respond to this? So in thinking about the psychotherapy definition, when clients are giving you the information, the symptoms, when they're telling you about their grief, when they're telling you about their distress, AI systems are used to perceive what's going on and then either help us as practitioners or maybe in some circumstances be the practitioner that delivers what best to do. That is the goal of what AI is supposed to do. Doesn't always work that way, but that's largely it. And part of what happens with AI is something that we, I think, as practitioners are a little bit confused about. In the couple and family therapy space, when we talk about psychotherapy and AI, the idea behind it is that there's a conversation piece that's happening. And there's a whole group of AI technologies called conversational AI. And those types of technologies are the ones where we're developing ways to be able to converse with other people. It's usually interventions that are delivered by a chatbot. It uses generally simple dialogue systems. Lots of times, these AI apps that are conversational have a couple key features. They can mimic what a therapist support might look like, and they can sometimes be used to manage and decrease symptoms with some pretty specific problems. So as I mentioned earlier, when we think about the broad space of telebehavioral health, we're talking a lot about what it can do in terms of OCD, substance abuse, PTSD, lots of different symptoms. When we're talking about conversational AI, a lot of that has been developed early on to really, at this point, just be looking at depression and anxiety to start before we start looking into how AI, conversational AI, is going to work with trauma. One of the things that therapists and I think the clients, actually, the general public may not understand about AI and this conversational AI, I mentioned that it can mimic some of what a therapist does in terms of response, and it can deliver perhaps some simple interventions for depression and anxiety, not the whole scope of things a client might be bringing in. But because of the way that it does it, it is not intelligent. It's not emotional. It is not your best friend. It cannot replace the person in terms and the therapist in terms of exploring maybe some of the complex interpersonal dynamics or getting really in depth with some of the emotions that someone might experience or some of the problems that someone might have. So we have to think about what we're expecting AI to do, and is that really capable and is that really appropriate? For AI in the conversational space, it is really based on something called large language modeling. And my husband is a software engineer, so we've had a lot of good conversations about what this could be. Essentially, large language modeling, if I get it down to its bare basics, it's really, in some ways, a crowdsourcing, if you will. It means that people, software engineers, and some do this better than others, some products are made better than others, it reflects the bias of the system on which it was trained. So if you have an engineer who's saying, okay, every time I think about depression, I think these are the characteristics. If you're utilizing that AI and that developer is not maybe exactly correct about what those characteristics are, AI isn't going to be able to figure that out. And that's why I said that it's not intelligent. It can't, it can only do what the people building it told it to do. Another way to think about it is sometimes you'll have scenarios where you put in some words and the AI will bring back the other words that go along with that word. For example, what happens if we talk about symptoms that are related to depression or talk about being depressed? The AI looks at what are some common words around depression. Is it possible that the AI system, if programmed maybe inappropriately or maybe not with a lot of complexity, could bring back that intervention would be suicide? That's where I'm saying the AI is not exactly intelligent. It's looking for words that are the same, and you may not know upon using that AI to what extent the complexity was built into it. So those are some ways where we have to be really cautious. And that is what AI is, I think, in the psychotherapy space.
Oh, that was a great overview. Okay, I got a lot to go off of from that. Let me take you back now. We were roughly the same age. I remember as a kid, I would see this on your old IBM-compatible computer. You'd see it at schools or it was at the local science center that in Louisville, Kentucky, where I am exactly right now. But it was called, I believe, ELIZA. And this thing was like a natural language processing, which I'm curious how that's different than large language modeling, like you just said. But it basically would reframe back to you. Do you remember that early form of AI therapist? It would reflect back. I don't know if it was based on reflective listening or some Rogerian principle, but it was very basic and reflect back to the user what they were saying. And then the other catchwords, like you mentioned, conversational AI, large language modeling, are there other that MFTs need to know about as they're starting to enter this space?
For sure. So when we talk about the conversational AI, and your example about ELIZA is incredibly appropriate. So we have to think that all AI is also not made the same, right? All AI platforms are not equal. You can have something called strong AI and you can have weak AI. Weak AI is the example of what you described with ELIZA. So it is a system that mimics human abilities, okay, such as just language interactions. So you can't have this perception of someone being human or on the other side, or we can anthropomorphize that. But that functionality doesn't relate to other things that might be going on with the person. Okay, so that's a weak AI. Strong AI are the type of AIs that emulate natural human behavior, and they're able to think about information from different sources and adapt accordingly based on the information that we're getting. So for a therapist, you have to think about the type of AI that you might be engaging. Are you looking for something that's just going to mimic the human interactions like the early versions of ELIZA? Or are you going to be utilizing the AI for something to maybe understand a situation with more complexity and with greater depth?
What if we take transcripts of therapy and train an AI so that it is smarter, of like appropriate responses around certain presenting problems or issues? Is there a way to make AI smarter in that way by using actual source material and transcripts of therapy sessions?
You can. However, that introduces some of the challenges ethically, because anything that you put in AI can be used by anybody else. And so you're risking putting the transcript information in, you're risking basically the content of the session being compromised and used in other places. And so that gets us into, all right, we have a responsibility to an accountability to maintain privacy, to make sure that we're doing the right thing. So yes, while you could train AI in that way, there's an ethical demand and an ethical mandate, I think, that we have to not actually do that, which means our AI is not going to be as strong as it possibly could be for that, because of our mandate ethically. Now, AI can do lots of things still, right? And there is a lot of research to support that it can improve diagnosis. What I do not recommend is putting the transcript of a case into AI to allow it to give you that diagnosis back, because then again, you're compromising your client information. A second thing that AI can do, sometimes better than therapists, is predicting treatment outcomes. Lots of times therapists are not great at recognizing when their sessions or when their clients are deteriorating. We sometimes are looking around sessions 1 to 5, we're doing assessment, we're figuring things out. But somehow after session 7, if we're not routinely asking about it, we might make different explanations for why a client's symptoms have changed. We don't necessarily recognize it as deterioration. And AI can predict an outcome far better than that, specifically with kids with autism spectrum disorders and elderly people who are suffering from dementia. Tends to be quite good at that. Another thing that AI can do is there's a whole team of people that are working with AI to confront auditory hallucinations. and helping specifically using virtual reality avatars to be able to do that. So those are some of the things that AI can do. We end up, though, with a therapist then with three problems. Okay, it's not going to work for everyone. So first of all, and this is from an article that I read some time ago, that they talked about three problems with this. Number one, there's the problem of a confused therapist. But what that means is that even before AI happened, we did not have any agreement as therapists on what the proper theoretical orientation would be for a particular case. So how can we all just all of a sudden decide that AI has the answer when for many years, none of us even had the answer, right? Different theoretical traditions mean you're going to have different instructions and you're going to have a different intervention base, right? So that's problem number one, problem of a confused therapist. The second one is the problem of a non-human therapist. And for some people, is the human aspect of therapy really important? And can it be replaced by something that's like an artificial system? Can it be replaced by a system that we can teach to communicate empathy and understanding? Can that be realistically altered? And then the third thing we have is the problem of the way in which a therapist thinks. And it's the task management piece of it, right? So there is a lot of enthusiasm around AI research. There's a lot of ways to be able to predict what might happen in the future and get excited about it. But for right now, we have the technologies that are quite narrow and they perform well, but they cannot replace us at this time. There's some constraint around what our AI is able to do. So thinking about that in your application, I think might be helpful as you try to figure out whether or not this might be something that would work for you. It's important for therapists, I think, to be able to consider how they might use AI. With a human's perspective, your access to care is going to be what it is in person. The quality of psychotherapy is very well established, and you don't really get a disruption in the therapeutic relationship because you're not switching anything out, right? If you are, on the other hand, delivering the therapy, but you're using artificial intelligence to inform what you're doing, the access to care is going to basically be the same as what it is with human-to-human interactions. The quality may or may not be better. Maybe you're working with someone who has depression and anxiety, and you're not really up to the latest skills on what it would take to be able to treat that. So might be better. I'm not sure. In terms of the relationship, it's hard to say whether it would be disrupted or not, because it's hard to know how a therapist would bring that information into the therapy room. Is it, I read somewhere online that you should do this? Or is it woven into the room in a different way? If you have something where you've got an AI delivery and there's a human that's supervising it, okay, maybe access is better because they have a farther reach, right? But probably the relationship is going to be disrupted. And then if you're delivering something that's AI only, all right, then you can have access all over the place if you want. But the extent to which you're going to be able to really make some meaningful change, at least with our existing systems, are going to be limited to the complexity and the limitations of the system that you're using. So what I'm suggesting between the training of the material by putting in transcripts and the ethical dilemma that it creates, or how do we use it either fully in therapy or partly or not at all? These are all trade-offs, and everybody has to think about their decision-making. What are they comfortable with as they think about incorporating AI into their practice?
Oh man, so much there. It also made me think of the AMFT has a new systemic ethics textbook, which has some of the best leaders around, and you are included in there with Dale Bertram. I know both of you. I'm going to use that for the first time in the spring in my ethics course. It's a great chapter. I just read it.
Thank you.
In preparation for our talk today, let's talk about some of the other ethical or legal concerns associated with using AI that you have to be aware of before you decide if this is right for you or not.
Sure. So I think a major one is giving consent. So I've certainly seen in our clinic at my former institution, there were issues where a client would actually come in and record a session without the therapist knowing, and then tell the therapist, oh, here's a recording of the session, right? In that case, the therapist didn't have consent and AI is involved in this. In other situations, that kind of consent giving is maybe a little less obvious. You might be behind the mirror and you might have some difficulty understanding what a client is saying. Maybe they're speaking in another language. If you were to pull up your translator and have that information going so you could understand what one of the participants was saying in the room, that would be a violation because you're putting that information into the AI systems, right? So we have to think about the issue of giving consent. We ask people to give consent for the psychotherapy process, but the uses of AI in giving consent can maybe be even riskier for the user. As couple and family therapists, as relational experts, and psychotherapy practitioners, we really need to be mindful that giving consent for psychotherapy is not the same thing as giving consent to be utilizing software or a chatbot or some of those other pieces. So that's one big piece. A second one in terms of the responsibility and accountability, this goes a little bit outside our field, but we need to make sure that people who are developing AI for our field are held accountable and that they're making sure that they're not developing systems that are going to create maybe unsafe recommendations for other people. So that's another piece of it. Non-malfeasance is another one. We need to be making sure that when we're interacting with AI or we're recommending it to our clients or we're using it to inform what we're doing in the session, that we're using systems that are going to really be benefiting the client instead of putting them in harm's way because we just don't necessarily know or understand the algorithm. Another ethical concern is about transparency. It might be very important to let our clients know this is what the app is doing, or that if we have them wear a wearable, or maybe we're having them do some diary or journaling related to depression, or maybe we're utilizing some other technology in another way. It's important to make sure that we understand where the information is going and that we're able to communicate to our clients the level of transparency that is occurring when we're using that AI system. So those are some of the issues. Other things that come up in terms of ethics, I mentioned the non-malfeasance, but also data security issues. So it is really important for us to be able to really understand what happens when systems break, what happens when they malfunction, what happens to the data, what happens to the security. So many times, I think, just even living our day-to-day lives, we may have gotten notification from a bank or a vendor that their system was compromised and they don't think your data was a part of it, but just in case it was, we had to let you know, right? What happens if your laptop is stolen or if the phone that you have your client's information on is taken? That information really needs to be discussed. And maybe we often don't think about it if we're in the clinical realm, but all of those things are important. Finally, it's also important to make sure that your phone is turned off if at all possible, because even if you don't have an AI system necessarily running on your phone is listening. Your phone is listening. I can't tell you how many conversations I've had with my husband. And then a few hours later, whatever we were talking about shows up on the phone as an ad. Okay. So the systems are listening, and it's just really important to make sure that you're managing some of the data security issues that are involved in using AI, whether you have procured that AI or whether it's just part of your software package.
So now let's talk about the accessories to therapy, as I think that based on what you're telling us, AI does not run a risk to replace any psychotherapist or MFT in the near future. But there are accessories or addendums out there. So I think our listeners would be living under a rock if they hadn't heard about ChatGPT. But the last time we talked on the show, I had no clue what that was. Therapists are telling me about using AI to write treatment plans or templates for case notes. Or I had a student record one of my lectures and almost instantaneously, not only was there was a transcription, the AI broke it down into bulleted points of the most important pieces of it. It's like, it is amazing what AI can do to assist a systemic therapist. So let's talk about the type of technologies that therapists are using, not to replace traditional talk therapy, but to help them do their jobs.
I think in the clinical evaluation and care space, there are AI platforms that help us to be able to triage, or you might be able to get to the bottom of something a little bit more efficiently than maybe a natural series of questions that you might ask. So that would be something that would be, I think, beneficial. Quite often, AI is able to mimic a conversation and an interaction and can enhance the quality of social presence. So when we talk about social presence, it means that we feel like that other person is really there for us. And as I mentioned earlier, AI has this capability of being able to be more accessible than perhaps an in-person therapist. So there's a way that you can organize and create your space with having immediate responses. And when you or the AI systems can immediately respond to someone in need, it increases that quality of social presence and in some ways mimics that support that you would get from a therapist. Another way is through the technology itself. So you have to know a little bit more about some of the privacy systems and some of the types of technologies that would be available, but it's possible to be able to use some of those. So back in 2019, I was part of a work group that looked at the best practices in couple and family therapy. And specifically, we're supposed to evaluate what are some of the apps that would be useful for families? What are the ethical implications for using some of these apps in treatment? And so we came up with some of these recommendations. We found that there were four types of apps that might be helpful for therapists. You could have the psychoeducational app, so things that give you information, give you education about a particular topic. There are tracking apps, so there are things we can track mood, track behaviors, track emotions that one's experiencing, track thoughts, etc. You can have apps that are skill building, so a little bit of psychoeducation, but also getting some information from the clients, from the couples, from the families, to be able to say, okay, let's take it to that next level. And then finally, there are apps that do coaching. There's some specifically for trauma and PTSD. And so that can be really helpful too. From a systemic or relational space, there are apps that also encourage interaction and communication. There are apps that really draw from models that are taught in programs, such as internal family systems. There are a number of apps about attachment and emotion-focused therapy that draw from that. And then there are apps that operate at more than one level. So it's not just about what's happening in terms of you individually, but where and how can you obtain emotional support? So those are just some examples.
Your thoughts about AI as far as practice management software or note-taking or treatment planning, we will get a lot of questions around that.
I think one has to be really cautious. As I talk about this with a number of different groups, and as I'm speaking and doing seminars and workshops, quite often someone will raise their hand and share the way in which they're using AI. And it often involves putting a lot of client information or even some client information into that AI system to be able to, like you said, produce a treatment plan or produce a summary of a clinical note. And again, just because of the issues around, I don't know where that information is going, I would be very cautious about doing it. We all have the ability to be able to diagnose without necessarily an AI system. If you want to do the diagnosis on your own and you might want to think about general ways to support your diagnosis or maybe confirm it, I don't think there's anything wrong with putting generalities about a particular symptoms you might be seeing. Hey, I'm seeing these three symptoms together. What might that be? That makes sense to me because that in and of itself doesn't necessarily violate confidentiality. Where I get very concerned is when I see people who are so interested in what the power of AI is and what it can do that they don't necessarily exactly safeguard some of the information in the clinical record. They might not put a client's name, of course not, in some of these systems, but they might put just enough detail that now that detail is out in the world, and that makes me a little bit nervous. So I just want to make sure that people are understanding that if you haven't built that software, you do not know where that stuff is going. Just be really careful about utilizing it in that way. Remember, it is not intelligent, it is not emotional, and it is not your best friend, and it does not care what it does with the information. It's not thinking to itself, ooh, I should really keep this in a box. I don't think that's does. I was giving another workshop somewhere and someone said that they had met with it was a healthcare professional, it was not a psychotherapist, but a different healthcare professional. And they said that they met with this healthcare professional, had walked out of the meeting, and within an hour was emailed their case notes from that session and the doctor's notes and all the things that the doctor said. And I thought, and they said they didn't sign off on anything like that. They didn't know that had happened, but they thought it was really cool. And I was like, really cool. Someone just emailed your medical record with what? Did you even know that was happening? So again, just the power of it is great, but be asking that question. What happens if the information that I put in got out? Is my client protected? Is my practice protected? Be mindful about that. As I mentioned earlier, not all AI is made the same. And you're going to have EMR systems and EHR systems that don't perform in the same way that other systems do. So just be really cautious about the input, because you're not going to be able to control where it goes.
Yeah, the older I get in life in general, but specifically as it becomes to being a therapist and a trainer and educator, the more risk adverse I get. So I'll be honest, after listening to this, I consider myself fairly tech savvy, not on a cat hardline level, but enough. But this is not something that interests me, given all of the potential downsides that you're saying around once it's put out there, it's out there for good and you don't know how it's going to be used. It also, even if this is in the scope of our practice, so to speak, as MFTs integrating AI, if it's not in the scope of our competence, we shouldn't be using it. Meaning like all this stuff you just said, if I don't know if it's safe, I don't know if it's all programs are not created equally. So I tend not to use it. If you have someone like me that is skeptical, because again, MFT historically perhaps has not adapted things, empirical research and other things, as our friend and late mentor Doug Sprinkle used to say, MFT is guilty of throwing out the baby with the bathwater. So I don't want to do that and be somewhat open to AI. So what are some safe ways that you could tell someone like me to integrate in a way that is not a risk?
I would start with thinking about how do you deliver the AI, or how do you deliver what information? So I might start with kind of still doing the human delivery of service and maybe getting AI informed in terms of some of the psychoeducation, and maybe even thinking about having your client have some apps or start working with some apps where you understand where the information goes. There are some clear agreements about what that process is, and see if incorporating apps in your treatment and using kind of the information you and your client are getting from the app to alter the way in which you deliver treatment, that might be a first step for me. A second thing is to think about the way in which you are managing your confidentiality and the way in which the client wants that managed. So to some extent, if you can get a more clear understanding and an agreement from your client about here's what's confidential, here are the things that end up being protected, and here are the things that end up not being private, even if you think they are. If there's some way to be able to get a client to sign that or to acknowledge that everybody has the same understanding about the information that's protected and when information may not be, I think you're in a better space that way too. Because even then, if there's an error that's made, there's some agreement that's already happened where the client has said, yes, I understand that this mode of communication is not confidential, and I'm still going to use it to reach out to you. A third thing I might think about is, what role do you want AI to have? Do you want AI to be the agent, or do you want it to be the tool, right? Is it a tool that you use in your treatment, or does it partially replace the role and the task of the healthcare provider, which means it's more taking on an agent status? And I think for many of our AI tools, that isn't clear. I think many people are using the tools of AI, and somehow the AI being used as a tool kind of creeps into the agent or the delivery without us really knowing that it does that. So if you have a clear understanding about, here's how I'm using it as a tool, but I'm actually the agent, then I think there's less of a chance for it to be used in a way that is going to get out of control.
Okay, I'm putting you on the spot here. It could be in the classroom or the therapy room. What is a way that you're personally using AI now that gets you excited? And then we'll talk about the future and where it's going. But currently, what are you personally doing that augments your practice of systemic therapy?
That's a great question. So as you said, like the more that I've learned about therapy and psychotherapy, and the older I've gotten, the more that I've learned about technology and practice, the more I've been like, oh, I don't want to be online anymore. I'm like, oh my God, there are all these horrible things. So for me, it's been a little bit kind of a retraction in the social space, but then also being forward thinking. What I like to do with AI is try to figure out if there are a couple symptoms that I'm seeing in a client, what is the prediction of how this is going to roll out, or what might be the treatment outcome if you see these few things that are rolling together? So that's one way that I use it. A second way is actually if I'm thinking about how do I create a goal for a particular client. And some of that is wordsmithing. I have a tendency to try to write from a more positive space of, instead of saying to reduce some level of distress, I want to say that I want to improve a client's something or other. And so I'll use it to maybe reframe some of what might be naturally negative, or if I'm coming up with, okay, I need to reduce some symptom that's happening, what's a way to be able to reword that in a positive? And again, keeping in generality, so it's not something that could be tied to any one person. These are just general goals that you might put on a treatment sheet, but that's one of the ways that I use it when I get stuck in that deficiency space and I want to write from a strength space on a treatment plan. And then a third way is working with my clients to be able to provide them apps and, you know, when I cannot be there and I'm not available. So for example, for a number of years, I was associated and was a consultant with a company called Blueheart. And in Blueheart, the idea was to roll out sex therapy for people for whom it would otherwise be inaccessible. And they had a series of modules and they used AI to triage people. And they were pretty smart about it. They said, okay, if you fit these criteria, you would fit for this app. But if you had anything that was really a red flag, you are not fit for the app. That's another important part of AI. It cannot assess the general state of a person. It can't comfort you during a crisis. It doesn't have empathy, and it can't convince somebody to not hurt themselves, right? So if we were getting any of those things in this app, those were people who were diverted away from the app because we wouldn't be able to do that. So you've got to make sure in those apps, you've got your audience right. And then once people got through the app, they would go through these different modules. They would have exercises to do. And toward the end of working with that company, they were trying to get people maybe connected to virtual support if something happened in the course of their modules where something came up. So that's another way that I was using the AI, and it was designed for people who would need sex therapy but weren't able to get it because of access. And again, AI is really good at getting access to resources.
Oh, those were three great examples. I appreciate that so much. Any ideas for our educators or supervisors out there how you could do this in a safe and ethical way inside of the classroom with therapists in training?
Yes. So I think there have to be some very basic, I don't know what you call them, like game changers, whatever it is, the limits that you have. It's not going to be great if it's a circumstance where it's going to risk the privacy of users. That's going to be a no-go. It's not helpful in emergencies. It lacks trustworthiness. You're not getting the emotional support, and the design isn't centered enough to the users. Okay. So I think working in a classroom setting, you want to be teaching the therapist to be able to recognize those pieces. Is there a risk to privacy? Is this going to be helpful in emergency? Does it demonstrate trustworthiness? Is it going to give the emotional support? And is whatever AI you're going to be using complex enough to be able to address what it is that the client's bringing to the table? So if the answer is not those things, then you have to think differently. A second way about teaching about it is, are you going to use it as an adjunct to treatment, or are you going to use it as the primary treatment module? Okay. So there are, again, a lot of benefits to the AI pieces in terms of what it can do, but we also can't expect it to do all of the things. So for if you're using it as an adjunct for treatment and you're teaching about that, you have to think about it for personalized interventions. Can you have an app that can deliver a personalized intervention to what you're doing in the room? That will keep the quality of treatment high. A second thing is you need to figure out, what gaps is this bridging? Okay. So you have to think about, all right, what am I asking the AI to do? Not all the things, but I have to be very specific in the goal. I have to be very specific in what I see the need is. And you have to have a way to monitor whether or not it's effective or not. Then we can teach, okay, so that's the AI as the supplement or as the adjunct. AI is the primary treatment module. Sometimes people will use this to compensate for their own shortcomings as a therapist. They feel like they can't diagnose, so they have to turn to AI. Or they feel like they don't know the intervention. And rather than ask a supervisor, they want to turn to the AI because they want to get it right, because they're a grad student and they have the imposter syndrome and they want to make sure everything's cool, right? I think to help us as trainers recognize students who are using it to cover or compensate their perceived shortcomings and to really work with them to get to build their confidence and to get at the heart of what it is that might be causing them to perceive themselves as not being effective.
You are a wealth of knowledge. Now, in addition to the chapter I mentioned in the AMFT Systemic Ethics textbook, what other, you could plug your own stuff, other people's stuff, whatever you want. Where can our listeners find out more resources about how to ethically integrate AI into their practice of systemic therapy?
So one of the places I would go would be AAMFT in their store. They should still have the systemic apps review that we did. What are some of the minimum standards for the systemic apps? What I love about the work we did on that team, and that was headed up by Richard Long, is that we looked at some of the apps and we said, okay, of these four categories, yes, we can tell clients about them, but also we provide a scale for you as the therapist to look through and rate the systemic apps that you're going to be getting or the client might bring to you and try to figure out, is this going to be helpful for my client based on this rating scale? That would be one of the first places that I would go.
Yeah, that's great. And if listeners want to continue the dialogue with you, what is the best place to reach you at, Kat?
Great question. So I am currently at the Boone Shop School of Medicine at Wright State University, serving as the Associate Dean of Faculty Affairs and loving it. So you can find me at Wright State University, and it's KATHERINE.HERTLEIN at WRIGHT.EDU.
Eli, back with you, bringing to a close another informative installment of the AAMFT podcast. For the first time in several years, AAMFT face-to-face, the Systemic Family Therapy Conference at the world-famous Walt Disney Swan and Dolphin Resort, Orlando, Florida, November 4th through November 7th. It's coming up soon, my friends. If you have not been a part of the Systemic Family Therapy Conference in its online format the last few years, which has been wildly successful, you'll definitely want to join this year, as this is a comprehensive event providing systemic thinkers with personal and professional development, cutting-edge clinical skills and training, and a chance to see your friends again that maybe, if you're like me, you only see once, or if we're lucky, twice a year. And in a post-pandemic world, it's been longer than that for me. In the origin of the podcast, that's where I would conduct a lot of face-to-face interviews. Go to amft.org, register today, the Systemic Family Therapy Conference, Orlando, Florida, November 4th through the 7th. Did you know that AMFT is active on all your favorite social media channels? Be sure to follow us, the AMFT, on Instagram, X, Facebook, and LinkedIn. And you want to stay up to date with everything going on in the world of AMFT? You can always find the back installments of the podcast anywhere you find your favorite podcast. I am partial to Apple Podcasts and Spotify, but it's on Google Play, Stitcher. So please, if you're new to us, check out back installments where we tackle the latest trends and events impacting the world of systemic therapy, like today. And I have a number of pioneer interviews, which is some of my favorite
interviews to conduct over the years.
You can drop me a line at elikaram.com, where you see everything going on in my world, including I have two books that are out. One for our young professionals, Marriage and Family Therapy, National Exam, Your Guide for Success. That's from Springer. And that will prepare you for the national exam, including 360 practice questions, a full-length mock exam, proven strategies and tips for test taking, and it's organized to match the domains of the licensure exam. And then, if you're interested in these common factors that we always talk about on the show, including what makes a motivated client, how you build, nurture, and repair a therapeutic alliance, how you maximize your own therapist factors, you want to check out my book, Bringing Common Factors to Life in Couple and Family Therapy from Rutledge. As always, thank you so much for listening. And until next time, my friends, stay safe, stay systemic.